Chapter 9. Ghost Fish. Missy is very quiet on the train home. John watches her anxiously, wondering what happened between her and Susan Tarleton, but she has not told them anything and seems more thoughtful than upset, gazing out at the warehouses and the red-bricked terraces scrolling by as the train transports them into the city. Once they arrive back in Baker Street, she goes straight up to her room, saying she needs to get herself ready for work. But John suspects she needs some time to recover from Holmes's revelation. He has tried to explain to Holmes that there might have been a better way to reveal the truth of Finn's death than simply detonating it in the middle of a conversation, but Holmes just looks at him blankly. They got what they wanted, didn't they? So what's the problem? The kitchen table is now covered with different pieces of paper from the cardboard box Susan gave them. There are letters, receipts, betting stubs, unpaid bills, newspaper clippings, invitations, old notebooks and photographs of Finn and Missy. Finn and Susan. Finn and many other women. At parties, on horseback, in bed. Her whole life, down to the last detail. Holmes spends 2 hours going through every last scrap, allowing nothing to escape his attention, not even the vet's report on a sick horse. John stays with him, partly out of loyalty, but mainly in the hope that he will find something that will provide some clue as to why Missy has been attacked and why some mysterious person is so determined to buy her house. And finally, he is rewarded. Holmes pulls out a sheet of headed paper. "Look at this, Watson," he hands it to John. The company name at the top of the sheet is the first thing that Watson sees. Sutro Legal Services. And there, beneath it, the legend, "The Law on Your Side." Watson reads on. "Dear Mr. Hudson, I've been asked to pass on my client's compliments at the satisfactory and discreet conclusion to the business recently conducted between your two parties. The agreed reimbursement will be available to collect from my offices at Middle Temple." "So Finn wasn't being threatened," John says. "On the contrary, he clearly provided whatever it is these clients wanted. And he was paid for it. What else do you notice about the letter?" John examines the paper, turns it over, sniffs it, rereads it, rubs a finger over the surface, then eventually concedes defeat. "I don't know." Holmes raises an eyebrow. "It's got an address?" John kicks himself. He was so desperate to find some exotic clue, a fingerprint or the dust and grime that Holmes seems to like talking about, that he has overlooked the obvious. The lawyer is based at the Inns of Court, home to London's most expensive law firms. Whoever these clients were, they must have had access to plenty of money. "Find anything?" Missy has come into the kitchen in her work tunic. She looks different somehow. The habitual lines of strain at the side of her eyes have smoothed, and she seems relaxed, even carefree. John realizes that whatever was said between her and Susan Tarleton, it may have given her the one thing she most needed. Closure. "Look at this." Holmes shows her the letter. Missy reads it. "He never told me about any payment," she says. "That date was just before we got together, but he never mentioned anything." "Maybe it was the proceeds of crime," John says, "and he was too ashamed to tell you. Could have been dealing drugs or something." Missy shakes her head. "Finn was never into anything like that. He was bad, but he wasn't an out-and-out villain." "He received money from a firm of solicitors, but he never talked about it," Holmes says. "So either he had too much respect for whoever was paying him." "Finn respected no one. Or he was afraid of them." Missy opens her mouth, but seems to have no answer to this. The silence is broken by a knock at the front door. Missy makes a move towards the hall. "Don't," John says. "If it was someone here to kill her," Holmes murmurs, "they wouldn't have knocked." "Wait here." John gets up and goes out, padding down the narrow hallway. There are no sounds on the other side of the door. Silently, he slides back the locks, takes a deep breath, and yanks it open. The visitor laughs. "Who gave me a fright?" In the light from a passing carriage, John recognizes the man from the station. Dr. Watson, my name is Edward Boyce. You helped me today at Victoria when I bumped into you. John recovers. He likes being called Dr. Watson, although he'd completely forgotten about the incident. Of course, Mr. Boyce, he says. Come in. I'll take another look at you and then we'll see about writing a prescription. It's only when the two of them are in the hall that John realizes he has no idea where to take his first patient. Holmes and Missy are in the kitchen, the sitting room is a mess, the upstairs rooms are clean, the bed's made, but won't that feel a bit weird? He's about to make an excuse and an apology when Holmes suddenly appears behind him. Please come through to the consulting room, Mr. Boyce. John turns and mouths a single word.
What?
Holmes gestures. Somewhat dazed, John leads Mr. Boyce into the sitting room, which, in the 1 minute he's been in the hall, someone has miraculously tidied. The bifold doors to the kitchen have been closed, and John's medical bag now sits on the coffee table between the sofa and the wingback chair. Holmes goes out, closing the door quietly behind him. John examines Mr. Boyce by the light of the gas lamp and asks further questions. The blurred vision has already been confirmed, but there are other causes for concern. Have you experienced recent weight loss? Are you hungry even while you were eating? How often do you pass water? The answers, along with the physical evidence, confirm his earlier diagnosis, that the man is a diabetic. A blood test would confirm it for certain, but John doesn't have the equipment here, so he will just have to trust his judgment. He writes out an insulin prescription from the dog-eared pad lurking at the bottom of his bag. We'll start you on low-dose tablets to begin with, as you may be able to reverse this with weight loss and a change of diet. Cut down on the sugar and carbohydrates, then come and see me in a month and we'll see how you're doing. Boyce thanks him profusely and delves into his jacket pocket, bringing out the correct amount of banknotes. John takes the payment and leads him back down the hall to the door. When he's seen the man back out in the street, he turns to find Missy and Sherlock peering out from the kitchen.
How did it go? Missy says.
Rather well, actually. He grins and hands over two of the notes.
The first installment on my rent.
It's a shame we have no room for a full-time surgery here, Holmes says. I have a feeling Dr. Watson could turn over a pretty penny.
It's true.
Just for a moment, John has a glimpse of an alternative future, but there's no way it can happen at 221 Baker Street. Quite apart from its cumbersome design, the house may have been too big for one person, but it is certainly too small for three. He cannot see patients in the living room. Missy is about to go to work, but it's out of the question that she should travel to the hospital on her own. The two men accompany her the entire way, and she promises she will come back in the company of another nurse or one of the porters. Then the two of them set off. It's just coming up to 5 when they emerge from Chancery Lane tube station and make their way to the law courts, easily identified by the number of clerks and notaries crowding the pavements with their piles of books and files. It's a strange thing that no matter how much of modern life has broken down, the law, like public houses, seems untouched. But hasn't that always been the case? It doesn't matter what is happening in the world. From the moment they were invented, lawyers have always found a way to be needed. Holmes and Watson enter a courtyard surrounded by grand, red-bricked buildings emblazoned with plaques and coats of arms. The place has an air of stability, with well-tended flower beds and a carp pond in which, to John's astonishment, considering the number of hungry people in London, there are still fat and nutritious fish. More men and women pass by in flapping robes and white curled wigs, coming in and out of doorways, hurrying up and down the stairs. John asks one of them for directions, and they are pointed to the top floor of the nearest building, Crowborough House. In contrast to the bustle outside, the interior of the building has an almost reverential hush. At the far end of the hall is a rickety iron lift, but they take the staircase, with its banister wrought into the shape of twisting vines loaded with fruit. A thick damson carpet mutes their footsteps as they climb the 6 flights to the top floor, emerging onto a small landing with a single door. A decal on the frosted glass reads, Sutro Legal Services. Holmes raps sharply on the glass, then, without waiting to be invited, walks in. A pool of smoke hangs over the desk and banks of filing cabinets. Sitting behind a computer is a man of around 50 in a suit of broad pinstripes. The first thing John notices about the lawyer is his obesity. The second is his gout, as evidenced by the purple swelling around the knuckles of the hand resting on the computer keyboard. It must be painful, but doesn't seem to have provoked the lawyer to make any dietary changes. He has half-moon spectacles perched on a bulbous nose, and although he has shaved, his cheeks are still grey. A greasy tumbler of what looks like port sits on the desk beside a full ashtray and a paper bag with a few flakes of pastry spilling out onto the polished surface. The lawyer's face is turned to his computer screen, eyes moving lazily beneath their heavy lids. He doesn't look up.
"New clients need to make an appointment," he drawls, in a gurgling tone that makes John want to clear his own throat.
"Mr. Sutro, I presume." There are two chairs in front of the desk, and Holmes takes one of them. "I hope I'm not interrupting anything. You look busy. Is it extortion today or blackmail?" The lawyer turns his attention to his visitor.
"I don't think I've had the pleasure," he replies sarcastically.
"My name is Holmes. I'm a friend of Missy Hudson, with whom you have been in correspondence. Your clients made an offer to buy her property, which she refused. I'd like to speak to them about it."
"We," John murmurs, taking the other chair. "We'd like to speak to them."
The man sighs and spreads his hands.
"Even ignoring the discourteousness of your opening remarks, I'm afraid I must inform you that I'm bound by lawyer-client confidentiality."
2 nights ago, Mrs. Hudson was attacked and almost killed. Your clients were involved." Sutro blinks his heavy eyelids.
"Do you have evidence for that assumption?"
"It's not an assumption, it's a logical conclusion."
"Mrs. Hudson has my sympathies, but as I have already told you, I cannot discuss any client business. I wish you a good day."
John leans forward. "Your letter said that unpleasantness might come her way. Judging by what happened to her, I think the police would see that as a clear threat." Sutro glances at his computer screen, and John thinks he sees a flash of unease. When he turns his attention back to Holmes, his expression has hardened.
"The police can assume what they like, but I can assure you that I've never threatened anyone. And you have no right to come here and make threats, no matter who you think you are. This discussion is over."
But Holmes doesn't move. Instead, he produces a letter from the lawyer to Finn Hudson and spreads it out on the desk. 4 years ago, you arranged a payment to be made to one Finn Hudson, Mrs. Hudson's husband. Will you tell us what it was for?"
No, I will do no such thing. I have asked you politely to leave my office. If you won't go, I'll call security, who have their own way of dealing with people like you."
Holmes is surprised. "Are you threatening me, Mr. Sutro?" Sutro gives him a cold smile.
"Which would you prefer?"
"Very well, I must apologize for taking up your valuable time. We will trouble you no longer." To John's surprise, Holmes repockets the letter and gets up. John follows him to the door, but on the threshold he turns back. "That's a nasty case of gout, Mr. Sutro. I suggest a change of diet. Cut down on the drinking and smoking and red meat, take some anti-inflammatory, or your heart will give out."
"Please close the door behind you."
Sutro seems unruffled by the visit, but it's only once the two of them have gone that his demeanor changes. He is worried. Putting his hands flat on the desk, he heaves himself out of his chair and waddles to the window. Once there, he presses his face against the glass until he sees Holmes and Watson leave the building. He stands there until they have crossed the courtyard and spends another few moments gazing pensively down at the fish sliding through the black water of the pond. Cornelius Sutro is a rich man, and has been for some years. This is largely due to the very clients about whom the two strangers were asking questions. His involvement with the Red Circle has brought him a life of luxury. He has properties in and out of London, and drives an expensive car. He goes on holiday in the south of France. On occasions, he has even flown. What it hasn't bought him is inner peace.
He has learned to live with a constant sense of unease, like a rheumatoid ache, and seldom a night goes by when he manages to sleep beyond 5 o'clock in the morning. Despite his appearance, he is smart enough to know that he has allowed himself to become part of something truly wicked. The Red Circle. Part of him wishes he had never heard the name. Perhaps it is the moment to call time on the relationship. It's a thought he's been having for some time, very much reawakened by the violent death of Dost Akbar and the huge loss of life in Richmond Park. And now this. Two complete strangers breaking into his inner sanctum, sitting there as if they had been invited, trying to pull him into their net. Impertinence of it. A sign of the times. It's time to go. He should have gone years ago. It will not be an easy conversation to have, but there are plenty of what you might call amenable lawyers in London. He might even be able to recommend one. Cornelius Sutro picks up the phone. Sitting in the carriage on the way to the Ark, Lestrade knows he should be considering the death of Dost Akbar and what might have been its cause. Was it suicide? And if so, what motivated him? Was it guilt? The financial consequences of so many lost lives? The fortified plate glass window was smashed, it turned out with a fire extinguisher, swung with immense force. Was Akbar strong enough? Or was he the victim of all this, perhaps knocked unconscious before he was thrown out? Lestrade has already been grappling with these questions, but all he can think about right now is his wife, Effie. He made a bad mistake 2 days ago, a stupid one. Consequences could very well change his life. After Akbar's death, he went straight back to his house in Kennington. There was nothing he could do until the ambulance and the forensic team had arrived, and he had no desire to spend the rest of the day liberally coated in another man's blood. He needed to go home for a shower and a change of clothes, and those had been the only thoughts in his mind as he had opened his front door and found himself face to face with Effie and Ollie on their way out to the park. He could still see the look of horror on their faces, particularly Ollie, who looked as if he was about to scream. Effie was scarcely any better, and cursing his own stupidity, Lestrade realized what had happened. He was covered in blood, and they thought it was his. He must have looked as if he'd been shot or viciously stabbed. "It's all right," he said urgently. "I'm fine. I've been involved in an accident, but I wasn't harmed. This isn't my blood. I'm sorry to have alarmed you. I didn't think you'd be in." Of course, Effie's first thought had been for Ollie. She had drawn protective hands across his chest, turning him away. "Go upstairs, Ollie, go into your bedroom and wait for me there." "But, Mummy..." "You heard what Daddy said, he's not hurt, but he's not very nice to look at, is he? You go and play with your toys and I'll sort this out." Ollie was frightened and confused, but he did what he was told, disappearing back into the house, leaving Effie and Lestrade alone. She remained in the doorway. She didn't want him to come in. "I'm sorry," Lestrade said.
"Do you have any idea what you look like?"
"Can we talk about this in 5 minutes? I really want to get showered and changed."
"You're going to give Ollie nightmares. You're giving us both nightmares."
"It was stupid of me. I should have thought."
"You never think. You never consider what I might be going through."
As Effie began to talk, Lestrade had realized that she had been building up to this for years. He should have noticed it. All the signs had been there, but he'd had his work. He'd had Ollie to worry about. There had never been time for her. She had folded her arms. She hadn't cared if this was the right place or the right time. She just had to get it out.
"I've had enough, George. I can't stand it anymore. Every time you go through that door, I worry about you. Every time you're late home, I imagine the worst. And just now, when I saw you standing there looking like something out of a horror film, it was as if all my nightmares had come true."
"A man committed suicide. He threw himself out of a building and..." But she hadn't let him continue. She put her hands to her ears.
"I don't want to know. I don't want to hear any more."
She waited until she was sure he wasn't going to interrupt.
"I hate living in this place. I hate London. This really is the city of the damned. Everything about it is dirty and dangerous. You know that, George. We put up with it because of your work. In fact, it is your work. You think you and your team can make a difference, but you know in your heart that's not true. You haven't got the resources. You've got nothing. There was a time, maybe 20 years ago when crime was under control, but now it's like a raging flood, a disease. Everyone is at it. In the streets, there are people threatening and hurting and killing each other because they know they can get away with it. And even if they end up in court, a crooked barrister will get them off or a corrupt judge will throw the case out. Don't argue with me. You've complained about it often enough. Even this house sickens me. I know you're proud of it. It's a perk of the job and you hardly pay anything for it. But how do you think I feel when I know that everything in it was paid for with other people's misery? It belonged to a drug dealer. Everything in it is tainted. And his clients still turn up when you're at work? They scare me and they terrify Ollie. How can you let your son grow up here, especially when he's so ill? When did you stop thinking of him? I never...
She held up her hand.
I am tired of worrying about him. I'm tired of worrying about you. I still love you, but in a way that just makes it worse, always thinking that one day I will have to manage without you, when there's the knock on the door that tells me that you won't be coming home. Like Baines and Bradstreet and Gregson and Jones, they all had wives and children, and just like you, they loved their job. You and I went to all their funerals. I'm not going to yours. What are you saying, Effie? I want to leave London. I want to go to Brighton and live near my sister and her family. And how am I supposed to support us? Susanna says there are lots of jobs in Brighton. You could stay with the police, but if you wanted to earn more money, there are lots of wealthy people down there, and there are security companies that look after them. Effie reaches out and takes his arm, her hand finding one small part of his jacket that isn't coated in blood. If you love me, George, if you love Ollie, please, think about it. All I want is for us to be together and to be safe. London is destroying us.
Boss? The voice snaps Lestrade out of his reverie. Hopkins is alerting him that they have arrived at the Ark. He parks his thoughts in the back of his mind. Just as no sane police officer will take his work home with him, nor is it sensible to bring your family life to work. He climbs down from the carriage, and he and Hopkins take the lift back to the 47th floor. Samantha Jones, Akbar's PA, has changed since the last time Lestrade saw her. For a start, she's dressed in black, not white. The shock of her boss's death is still with her, in her eyes, in her entire manner. She will not be the only one. Her business empire has just lost its emperor. All over the world, there will be people who need to earn a living and who will be wondering, what happens next? Akbar's office is off-limits. The whole window has been smashed, and at that height, the wind will be unbearable. They meet in a conference room, the three of them sitting at a glass and metal table big enough for 15. Lestrade begins. Samantha, you don't mind if I call you that, do you? She shakes her head. How long had you worked with Dost Akbar?
5 years,
she says, her voice tremulous. How well did you know him? The question puzzles her.
He was my boss.
I know that, but you must have spent a lot of time with him. Did he ever confide in you? Perhaps he might have shared some of his thoughts and feelings.
I only saw him when he was in London, but he trusted me. He was very informal. We often talked together.
He was obviously very upset about the plane crash.
Of course he was upset. He felt it was his responsibility. He was dreading having to go to Paris to talk to the relatives. All those people who lost their loved ones.
Do you think it could have driven him to take his own life?
No, Chief Inspector. What happened was a horrible accident. He made some dreadful accusations in his office, but he wasn't to blame.
Did he have any other worries? Hopkins asks. She laughs mirthlessly.
He ran a multi-billion-pound business empire. What do you think?
I think my colleague is asking you if there were any specific problems that were preying on his mind. Lestrade lets the thought hang in the air. There may have been something that he mentioned to you.
Well, there was another summit coming up. That was always very stressful for him.
A summit?
It was what he called it. He used to say it was like the Mafia, although there was nothing very sinister about it. Just a group of businessmen getting together for their mutual benefit. They met 3 or 4 times a year to discuss market trends, opportunities, new technology, that sort of thing. They were all very successful, very powerful, and if you want me to tell you their names, I can't help you. It was highly confidential. But I could always tell when there was going to be another meeting. Mr. Dost would become quite anxious.
And there was another summit about to happen?
I believe so.
Do you know where? Samantha shakes her head.
It would have been arranged by his assistant in New York.
So, Akbar was an informal sort of boss, which might be another way of saying that he and his PA were romantically involved. He felt responsible for the crash, but he didn't blame himself. He didn't seem to be a man who was easily scared, and yet he was part of a cabal of businessmen who definitely made him nervous. Samantha Jones refused to believe he had killed himself, and yet only he could have smashed the window and thrown himself out. What could have prompted it? Thinking back to the fateful meeting in the Ark, Lestrade remembers the exact moment that the mood in the room changed. Akbar had seen something, noticed it for the first time, and a look of horror had crossed his face. But when Lestrade looked around, all he had seen was a blank wall hung with that abstract painting. It is the painting that has stuck in his mind. "What can you tell me about the artwork that hangs in Mr. Akbar's office?" he asks. "The one opposite his desk."
"The Kandinsky."
It's funny how Samantha spits out the word, as if everyone in London owns a masterpiece by one of the 20th century's greatest abstract painters.
"He bought it from the Tate."
30 years ago, the London art galleries began selling off their collections. All the Turners from Tate Britain, 9 centuries of art from the National, Hockneys and Freuds from the National Portrait Gallery, Fragonard and Franz Hals from the Wallace Collection. Of course, the purists protested, but the galleries were bankrupt. Nobody was visiting anymore. And when the plutocrats arrived with their checkbooks...
"He paid 50 million for it, but he said it was a bargain," Samantha continues. "He loved art, particularly 20th century. What do you want to know?"
"I'd like to see it."
"The office is closed off."
"I think they'll open it for us." They leave the conference room and walk down the corridor to the glass door, now barricaded with blue and white tape. Police. Crime scene. Do not cross. A single policeman is positioned outside, but he recognizes Lestrade and salutes. Lestrade turns to the PA. "Thank you for your help, Samantha, but we don't need you to come in." Samantha Jones is relieved. She never wants to go in there again. Stepping into Dost Akbar's office is like entering a vortex. The wind is howling in through the smashed window, and Lestrade and Hopkins are sent reeling back. It's almost impossible to stay upright. There are glass fragments all over the carpet, and the smashed window is like something out of a science fiction novel, a gap between 2 dimensions. It's impossible to avoid the 47-story gap. Hopkins finds himself leaning against the far wall, as if the wind will pluck him out and send him hurtling to the pavement below. He remembers Dost Akbar, or what remained of him after he fell. He mutters something to Lestrade, but his words are snatched away and wasted. On one side is the desk where Dost sat. In the middle of the carpet, lying on its side, is the fire extinguisher that Dost must have used to smash the window. Strange that such a modern building should have contained such an old-fashioned device, but perhaps... in its own way, it was an artwork too. The painting is opposite, firmly screwed to the wall, which is just as well. Had it been suspended on a hook, it would be on the other side of town by now. The painting consists of 12 simple boxes filled with coloured circles. It is vibrating in the wind.
"What are we looking for, sir?"
Hopkins shouts above the maelstrom.
"I don't know,"
Lestrade shouts back.
"But this may help."
He takes a dog-eared paperback out of his pocket. He found it in a shop called Tulliver's, just off the Charing Cross Road, once the centre of London's book trade. Of course, that's all gone now. In today's London, fine editions are as likely to end up in the fireplace as in a library. It's a strange world where a first edition Tolstoy is worth slightly less than a bucket of coal, but that's how it is. Somehow Tulliver has survived, serving a loyal clientele who still believe that one day the world will go into reverse gear and art and great literature will return. The book is called Kandinsky, The Complete Works. Surprisingly, it contains colour plates of all the artist's works, more than 200 of them. The titles mean nothing to Lestrade. Blue Crest, Quiet Pink, rays, yellow border. Nor are they particularly helpful in identifying the painting that hangs in front of them. But at least he can avoid the earlier works, which actually show scenes he can identify. Mountains, horses, and so on. As the artist got older, he seemed to wander into a world of his own. The later works are all much of a muchness. Or so it seems to Lestrade. It takes him 30 minutes, and perhaps he's lucky. His eyes were already getting tired, trying to separate all the different blobs and squiggles, the zigzagging lines, the geometric shapes. But turning a page, he suddenly sees that he has found it. There it is, composed in 1913. Squares with concentric circles. At least the description is accurate.
Is that it?
Hopkins calls out.
That's right. It's identical.
But is it? Lestrade looks up at the wall and the £50 million original. He looks down at the page, then up at the picture again. He looks back down. He's no art expert, but he has a policeman's eye, trained to observe the tiniest detail, and he sees that there is one difference. In the left-hand corner of the picture on the wall, there is a red circle. In the book, it is a different colour. Yellow. How can that be? He stands there, buffeted by the wind.
What is it, boss? Hopkins says. What do you see?
But Lestrade has no answer. Is the picture a clever forgery? Did Akbar suddenly realize that he'd been cheated? And was that what drove him to suicide? The fact that he'd been duped out of millions? No. That makes no sense. The man was a billionaire. A bad art purchase wouldn't have made him jump to his death. Remembering the way the businessman stared down at his hand as he backed away from the wall, Lestrade walks forward and examines the red circle. It has been added recently. The actual circle should be yellow. He can see the true colour underneath. The new oil paint has been overlaid quite clumsily, and the colour is quite wrong. Lestrade can see that now. It's modern paint, emulsion, quite different from the oils Kandinsky used. An act of vandalism? But why? What does it mean?
Is that what upset him? Hopkins cries. Someone came in here and defaced his precious picture. No.
Lestrade shakes his head. Any decent restorer could remove the red colouring and bring it back to its original state. Dost might have been annoyed. He wouldn't have been suicidal.
Then what was it?
Lestrade holds up his hand to silence his deputy. Something is plucking at the back of his mind. He has seen something like this before, and recently. But with the dozens of crime scenes he's attended over the past few months, and the hundreds of CSI pictures put in front of him, he simply cannot recall what it is. A sudden gust makes Hopkins stagger into him. The roaring of the wind has risen in pitch, howling around the room like Akbar's unquiet spirit. Is there a storm coming? If so, it really is too dangerous to stay here. Anyway, there is nothing more to discover. Lestrade has got what he came for, even if he still isn't quite sure what it is. They leave and take the lift back to ground level. It feels good to be out in the street, although Lestrade has to force himself to blank out what happened the last time they stood here.
Back to the office, sir?
Hopkins asks.
Yes, we'll grab a cab if one passes.
The two of them walk together, Lestrade deep in thought. Hopkins wants to know what his boss deduced from the office and the vandalized painting, but he knows it's best not to ask. It will all come out in its own time. However, as they reach a set of traffic lights on the Strand, another thought crosses his mind.
I forgot to tell you, sir. There was a report of a mugging last night. That nurse you're friendly with.
Lestrade's head snaps round.
Missy Hudson?
Yes, sir.
Is she okay?
A double-decker bus trundles past, pulled by two horses.
Fine. Some guy fought him off and he fled the scene. She called in a description, but...
Well, you know. Lestrade knows. The police computer systems are unreliable. It can take weeks to get information from the forensic laboratories. Fingerprints have to be taken manually and examined one at a time, and facial composites, what used to be called identikit, are almost useless. He remembers what Effie said to him. You haven't got the resources.
You've got nothing. Maybe she's right. Would Brighton be so bad? And he has to think about Ollie.
I've asked for some extra patrols in the Baker Street area, just in case, Hopkins says as the lights turn red.
That's it. That's where he last saw a red circle.
Holmes and Watson have not left the law court. They're sitting in a coffee shop on the corner and have been for more than an hour, watching the lawyers leave, their black capes flapping out behind them like strange birds as they hail cabs and landaus to take them home. Holmes has ordered a third round of tea cakes.
This is a bad idea, John says.
I can assure you the tea cakes are excellent.
I'm talking about breaking and entering.
There was no other way Mr. Sutro was going to give us the information we wanted. He made that much clear. If we want to know who made the payment to Finn Hudson, we're going to have to find the information for ourselves.
But the end of the day has come. They have a good view of the only exit from the law court, but there is no sign of Sutro. By 6:30, the last landau has driven away, and the street is deserted.
Maybe he's working late, John suggests.
Mr. Sutro did not give the impression of a man who burns the candle at both ends for his clients, Sherlock responds.
Then maybe we missed him.
Given his girth, that's unlikely.
Holmes sighs and cancels the third tea cake. They pay and leave.
The inns are almost deserted now. Night has not so much fallen as pounced. A few of the lanterns above the doors remain lit, but their feeble glow leaves much of the courtyard in darkness.
They keep to the shadows, skirting the walls of the buildings as they make their way to the entrance of Crowborough House.
There are no lights on inside, but the door is still unlocked, so someone may still be there. When they reach the top of the stairs, John is relieved to see that the frosted glass is dark. Sutro has gone home. The door is locked, but Holmes quickly deals with that. His methods are far from subtle. Using his elbow, he smashes the glass window, then leans in and opens the door from inside. They enter the darkened office.
Fortunately, the light of the moon is casting just enough light to allow them to see what they're doing.
Holmes moves towards one of the filing cabinets and opens the top drawer.
What are we looking for, exactly? John says.
Anything about Finn or Missy? Just search through the files, try H for Hudson.
It seems that Sutro dealt mainly with what might be called corporate affairs, if embezzlement, fraud, sexual harassment, blackmail and protectionism fall into that category. Amongst the papers that John examines, there are details of cases brought against several well-known politicians and industrialists. Not many of them ended up in court. The plaintiffs were more frequently hushed up with payoffs or threats. It could take all night to go through the copious files. It's clear that Sutro was keeping a lot of secrets. Additionally, there are drawers jammed with receipts, meals, clothes, nights in hotels, often with company. There are threatening letters, begging letters, angry letters, but Sutro has been kind to them in at least one respect. Everything is clearly marked. Lazenby, fraud. Milverton, blackmail and subsequent murder. Kepler versus Kepler. British Arms Association, bankruptcy. The labels are wonderfully indiscreet. An hour passes, then Holmes exclaims,
"Got it!"
John looks up.
"What?"
Holmes holds out a file marked with two words. Baker Street. Inside is a sheaf of papers.
"This is what we came for," Sherlock says with satisfaction.
He begins to riffle through the pages.
"Shouldn't we do that at home?"
John mutters, nervously glancing at the door.
"It's always possible that security guards patrol the corridors. One of them might even have heard us."
"Here, a large payment with Finn Hudson's name."
Holmes holds up the written proof.
"He was paid £30,000 5 years ago, on July 18th. The payment was made through the City and Suburban Bank."
"Does it say who the money came from?"
"From Sutro's business account. I imagine his clients paid him, and then he forwarded the money to make tracing its origins more difficult. Bank statement might tell us where it originated. We should talk to City and Suburban."
"I won't give that sort of information to the public. I have to tell the police. Come on, we should go."
"One more minute. I need to check there's nothing else of importance."
John goes to the window to check that nobody's approaching,
but the courtyard is still deserted. Far below, he thinks he can make out the shape of the white carp gathered in a shoal beneath the surface of the dark water. There are rather a lot of them. They don't seem to be moving. Finally, Holmes is ready, and they leave the office, padding quickly down the stairs. They emerge in the moonlight courtyard and are about to make their way to the exit when Holmes comes to a halt so abruptly that John almost walks into his back. He says nothing. He is staring straight ahead. "What is it, Holmes?" But then John follows his gaze. They are standing just a few paces in front of the carp pond. The water is glinting in the moonlight, and beneath it the carp are still gathered in a broad shoal. They haven't moved. "Good God," John mutters. It wasn't fish that John saw from the office window. There is a man in the water, lying face down, completely still. His hands are floating on either side of his head. His grey hair wafts around his head. His body looks enormous. It is Cornelius Sutro, of course. It had to be. Somehow Holmes and Watson heave him out onto dry land, but there is nothing they can do for him. It has been said that drowning is the ugliest way to die, and although he cannot have been there long, he must have hit the water when the courtyard had emptied. His eyes and skin have a dreadful undertaker's pall. No one else has seen them. They stand alone with the dead man. "There were no signs of injury," John says quietly. "So my guess is a heart attack. He left the office late. When the courtyard had emptied, he collapsed here and drowned." "As I'm sure his murderers intended."
"Sorry?"
"Look at the footprints," Holmes points down at the soil. "See how only the toes of his shoes have made the impressions? He was running. What would persuade a man of Sutro's weight to run?" He looks round at John. "Terror. My guess is that they were intending to kill him by more traditional means, but he saved them the trouble." John glances back at the corpse. "In that case, we should call the police." "There's no point. All they will see is a fat man who had a heart attack." They walk home. Holmes says nothing more, and John wishes he would share his thoughts. Nothing makes any sense. Finn received a great deal of money, but it is still unclear why. Sutro presumably wanted to buy 221 Baker Street, but as is clear, Finn didn't sell it, so why was the money paid to him? Missy inherited the house and wanted to keep it, but she was threatened and almost killed. Why? And who has now killed Sutro? What did he know? It seems that Watson and Holmes have stepped into a bizarre conspiracy. They have no answers, but their enemy is getting closer, and his face is still unknown.